Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And, well, we've got a bit of a conundrum to talk about. You know, the Constitution is just continually being trampled on. And there's just no end to this. But before I dive into the Electoral College and what we're supposed to be doing, because I do this when we hit Constitution Day, but because this, the dynamics of this election cycle has proven the necessity of diving into this. So we're, hold on, folks. We're going to get into that, but I have to give you the obligatory it's now or never. So I can't think of anything more than that other than the debt. So the challenge is, what is it that motivates people to actually take a stand and say, you know what, this can't be right. This can't be legitimate. They can't have this unbridled, this unvarnished, this completely unfettered control over every aspect of our lives to where they can get away with killing us. Whether it's spraying over our head, whether it's poisonous in our food, or poisonous with it and altering our DNA, they don't have these authorities. They have assumed these, and we, the sheeple, the blood is on our hands because we're not holding our public servants accountable. Now, I will tell you, you know, I got one candidate that I know of that it's actually out getting their pledge endorsed. Now, if you look at the endorsement, the only reason that those things aren't up there is because I'm not making it easy anymore. You want to be serious and you want me to endorse you, you have to sign the pledge, and you either have to have it notarized that you're actually going to do this, and or you actually sign it with the sheriff so the sheriff can hold you accountable. And so I think that's all important. Now, I do know that in blue states, and or I should say blue counties, where, you know, integrity, honesty, and abiding by a contract means nothing, because that's where we are today, folks. The Constitution being a compact, regardless of any of these conservative idiots out there telling you it's not, proved to me that Madison and Jefferson didn't say that this Constitution was a compact and that the parties to it were the states. Proved to me what the framers actually said, because it's easy for anybody to make any wild butt assertions. And there are these lawyers out there trying to actually defame or pervert the Constitution. And so, unfortunately, we, you know, we're being bombarded with all sorts of misinformation and all sort of, we'll get into that. That's kind of the side of the Feedback Friday, but let me get back into the debt. That debt, I believe, is the number one issue. And I've had this conversation this week that I can't think of any other issue that can actually get people motivated to take a stand and go, you know what? We can't allow that to do, you know, for that to undo us. We can't allow this illegitimate debt. And most people, you'd think that they'd start standing up. I mean, Aristotle basically identified that the two reasons why people revolt is because there's no food. Do you have to starve to death? I honestly think that we're heading down this path where the will of the people, they're probably altering, and as wild as this may sound, they're, with the chemtrails and everything else that they're putting into our food, they are probably altering our ability to resist. In other words, they're basically, we've been transfigured into lab rats. And that we're just going to accept our condition in the cage and not challenge anything. And I don't want to believe that. I can't believe that. So with that, let me just dive into the Electoral College, because that's where we are right now. the Electoral College has been violated and the process has been perverted because the parties took control of it. And so what I need to do is I need to give you the baseline of what the Constitution dictates. And so I need to line this up so it's all very, very clear. So when we go to Article 2, Section 1, right there in the next couple of paragraphs, and I kind of break it down between the state responsibility and Congress's responsibility. This is what Article 2, Section 1 states, and this is regarding the Electoral College. Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. In other words, they're the ones that appoint how, because we already know how many electors they're going to get. The electors are all based upon the seats in Congress, which means the House of Representatives as well as the Senate. So if you have seven representatives and two senators, because every state has two senators, then you get nine electors. And so, in other words, your state legislature, based on how this originally was defined, they would have to direct how you would choose. Now, we've gone through the ratification debates, and it is the people to choose their electors. We're a Republican form of government. And this was the one process where the people were to choose who their electors were going to be. And so this is why, when we look in why counties matter most, I actually proved to you that they came to a point in the 1830s where every state in the Union, except for South Carolina, every state in the Union allowed the people at large to choose their electors. That continued until 1856. 1856 is when the parties convinced everybody that if you let them have primaries, they can downselect because there's just too many names. There's just too many. And I believe what really should have happened is that the only way you actually get for a presidential candidate to actually become a legitimate presidential candidate is you have to have electors that are sponsoring. In other words, see the process and the process, the way they did it. George Washington didn't run around all the states and say, hey, who's going to be my electors? So what had to happen is people had to step forward. And in the original days, there was probably just these sages that said, they just voted for these people because they had this faith. But what ended up happening as it went to Jefferson and Madison's elections, there were electors who became champions of the individuals. And so when Madison was first elected, his very first campaign, he didn't even campaign. He just wrote letters to the Jefferson electors and those who were going to replace them and basically says, full steam ahead. I'm going to be doing the exact same thing, and I hope to have your endorsement. And so these electors campaigned that they would elect Madison. And that's how Madison didn't spend a penny. Folks, just fathom that. Madison, in his first election, hardly spent anything except for maybe some postage. He didn't travel. He didn't do campaign speeches. That's what the electors do. And oh, by the way, when you really think about it, you could be having a dialogue in your legislative district, especially if you do it in your legislative district. This is why I believe that the state should actually do it the way we should be electing. In other words, when you're voting for your congressperson in the general election, you should also be voting for your elector. And that elector would be campaigning on who they're going to vote for. This is how it should be done, to where we don't even see the names. We don't go through primaries, and we do not go through caucuses, where we get to play the politics and the power brokering. Because when power brokering is being done, this is how the globalists can actually bring in and control the outcome. This is why we've had nothing but globalist presidents. So, going back to Article 2, Section 1, and so the state shall appoint in such manner as the legislatures may direct a number of electors. In other words, the manner of how, the manner is the process of how you are to vote for them. And so, you know, is it going to be statewide? Is it going to be local? Is it going to be, and is it going to be on ballot? Is it going to be by voice? Because many times back in those days, the sheriff would probably just have, they would have one day, you'd have to assemble at the Capitol seat, and you'd have to register with the sheriff and pay your poll tax, and then you'd cast your vote. And it may be just, you know, who do you vote for this, this, and however they did it, the state legislature had the ability to kind of control the electorate. And this is where many states, where the state legislature just did it. They actually just appointed the electors. That's not what it says here. Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislatures may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled to Congress, but no senator, representative, or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed as an elector. In other words, this person can't have any public service job at all. But to be clear, when they went through the ratification debates, it was delineated in the ratification debates that we, the people, were to choose. We're the ones that are going to vote our elector just like we vote for our representative in Congress, not our senator. At that point in time, they were being appointed by the state legislature. So the state legislature assumed, well, we see this appoint there, and that's when they started assuming the power. People weren't happy with that. Anyway, and then this next part, the electors shall meet in the respective states and vote by ballot for two persons, of whom one at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. So this is where this concept, oh, well, you can't have a president and a vice president from the same state. That's not true. It's only that in each state, you're forced to vote for two separate people, one can be a resident, but the other one can't be if one is. So, in other words, you can only vote for one resident of your state. They just wanted to make sure that there wasn't this, back in those days, where, you know, everybody voted for the same, and they made it kind of hard, but it didn't mean that you couldn't be a vice president. Because look at Madison and Jefferson. Madison and Jefferson, and actually, if I remember correctly, Madison was never the vice president, and it was the Secretary of State, and that's why they did that. But the language here is clear that each state could do this, and mathematically, there's no reason why you can't actually have, because there's no language at all that says a vice president and president cannot be from the same state. It only means that the electors cannot choose from the same state. Anyway, I digress. And so, and they shall make a list of all the persons voted for and the number of votes for each, which list they shall sign and certify and transmit sealed to the seat of government of the United States, directed to the President of the United States. The President of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates, and the vote shall be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes shall be the president, if such number be a majority of the whole number of elected. And if there be more than one who have the majority and have an equal number of votes, then the House of Representatives, because they go through all these different conditions. And so if they go through the number of votes, and then the House of Representatives shall immediately choose by ballot one for them, and if no other person have a majority, then the five highest on the list of the said House. So this is where they start creating this list, and they break it down. And as you look at this, they kept on breaking it down and breaking it down in 1800. What I mean by that is they had John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and, you know, they couldn't come to no one had a clear majority. And there were all of these other votes out there, like Aaron Burr and so forth. And so they voted like several times, 60 times, something like that, where the House of Representatives ended up choosing, and it was a bunch of power brokering. So the 12th Amendment literally changes this process so that they don't keep on voting and voting, starting with five and then playing around with five again. So what they did in the 12th Amendment was they clarified all of this. So at this point, because everything else that is a part of the Electoral College has been replaced by the 12th Amendment. And so the 12th Amendment basically lays it out that the electors shall meet in their respective states. And this is the difference. This is the 12th Amendment difference. And vote by ballot for president and vice president, one of whom at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. They shall name in their ballot the person voted for as president. See, before it was just writing two names on a piece of paper. And then whoever got the most amount of votes, who had total, became president. And then who got the second amount of votes became vice president. But what they did was they literally changed it so that the electors would choose who they wanted for vice president, and those votes would be counted, and who they wanted for president, and those votes would be counted. And so on distinct ballots, the person voted for vice president, they shall make distinct ballots of all persons voted for president, and all persons voted for vice president, and the number of votes for each, which shall list, they shall sign and certify and transmit sealed to the seat of government of the United States, directed to the president of the Senate. The president of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates, and the votes shall be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes for president shall be president if such number be a majority of the number of whole number of electors appointed. In other words, it's a clear majority, and today that's 270. Now, this is what happens if they don't have a clear majority. Because remember, they had five top. You had the person that had the most and the five next highest. So they had a runoff of six other people. And so, and back in those days, in Thomas Jefferson's time, all six people, there was a lot of shenanigans. And this is one of the reasons why in that election of 1800, there was a power brokerage deal that basically who was it? Aaron Burr decided to, pull back his desire to be president, and was willing to throw his followers' votes to Jefferson. I believe that was what ended up happening. And that's everybody looked at that as like some really dirty shenanigans, which it wasn't, but it was a very long, compromising process to where enough people said, we do not want John Adams, because John Adams never came to the point of having a clear majority. And that's when everybody realized, okay, well, this union of Aaron Burr, because then Aaron Burr thought that he would be in line for the presidency in the next session or in the next term or what have you. And as if I remember correctly, Aaron Burr, I don't believe, finished his four-year term. Anyway, so this is what the states do. And if no person shall have such majority, then from the persons having the highest number, not exceeding three on the list of those voted for as president, the House of Representatives shall immediately by ballot, the president shall choose immediately by ballot the president. But in choosing the president, in other words, out of the top three, but in choosing the president, the vote shall be taken by states. In other words, it's not everybody gets a vote in the House of Representatives. It's the state. So the state of California chooses this person. The state of Louisiana chooses this person. So in other words, there will be a total of 50 votes cast today if we went down, if 2020 went the way it was supposed to go. And the House of Representatives was to choose the president, Donald Trump would have become president, period. And so, because there's only 50 votes, and there was definitely not enough votes for Biden. Anyway, but in choosing the president, the vote shall be taken by states, the representative from each state having one vote. A quorum for this purpose shall consist of a member or members of two-thirds of the states, and a majority of the states shall be necessary to a choice. If the House of Representatives shall not choose a president whenever the right of choice shall devolve to them before the fourth day of March next following, then the vice president shall act as the president. So in other words, if at this point they don't have a president because the Electoral College, folks, listen to what I'm saying. The Electoral College chooses the president and the vice president. There's no tickets. So if there's not going to be a president, and right, we'll get to this, we'll get to how they perverted all this. But as it goes forward, if a president that the let me go ahead and finish this, and then I'll dive into what I'm trying to say. The person having the greatest number of votes as vice president shall be the vice president if such number be the majority of the whole number and appointed. Let me finish what I said. And if the House of Representatives shall not choose a president whenever the right of choice shall devolve upon them before the first day. So in other words, if they can't choose a choice, then the vice president shall act as the president, as in the case of death or other constitutional disability of the president. The person having the greatest number of votes, in other words, if just think about it, if they couldn't come to terms with actually choosing a president, then the vice president is chosen by the electors, would then serve as president. And the person having the greatest number of votes as vice president shall be the vice president if the number shall be the majority of the number of electors appointed. And if no person have a majority, then from the two highest numbers, the Senate shall choose the vice president. In other words, they go by the two highest in choosing the vice president out of how the electors voted from the states. In other words, the point is they only have one shot at doing this. They can't go back and re-vote and re-vote and re-vote. They have one shot of choosing the president. They have one shot, and based on this, they basically go to, and I think it is based on the top two or three, what was it? Shall choose immediately by ballot, but in choosing by the states, the representatives of each state have one vote, a member of the two-thirds choice, the right of choice upon them. Yeah, so they're basically saying that they'll only take the top two. And the top two for the Senate will actually be whoever wins that will become the vice president. And if they don't choose a president, because they can't come to a majority that first time, then the vice president will serve. And then they could go on to, this is the last of it, and the majority of the whole number shall be necessary to a choice. But no person constitutionally ineligible to the office shall be eligible to that of vice president of the United States. Now, this is a huge conundrum, because what we have is we have the states already choosing Biden as the electors. In other words, when you went through the caucuses and everybody voted in the caucuses or in your primary just a few months ago, it was March for a lot of people. That's when they had some of the super primaries. But from the beginning, January till May or whenever the last primary was, every state chose out of the selection of candidates. You had Nikki Haley, Vivek Ramaswamy, you had Trump, you had all of these candidates. And when you, the people, chose Trump, that means he basically got the electors, because that's how the party took over. Based on the party and the party primaries, when we, the people, voted, the electors were locked. In other words, you now got Trump vote, you know, Trump electors in your state. And the same thing, because they actually allowed this to happen, instead of voting separately for a separate elector, the primary took over tickets. And so technically, your elector for president was Trump, and your elector for vice president was to be determined by the RNC with the convention. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so some states that have caucuses, it doesn't matter. When the party decides who the president is, the electors are locked. The party also locked in that the president would choose his, help me out here, his running mate. Now, the incumbent always had the benefit, but see, here's the problem. If the incumbent is going to run and they choose to run, then that's it. And if the incumbent, and they go through this and they basically said that they're going to maintain their ticket as they initiate the caucuses and the primaries, then the electors are locked for both the president and the vice president. Those ballots have been cast by the people. In other words, that's how they locked it down to keep anybody, any good person, from competing, from getting out there and competing and taking the presidency instead of letting, you know, the party have control. So that's why the party's actually got the state legislatures to create these laws of caucuses and primaries to lock down the electors. So in the general election, when the people choose, the choice is between the different parties, not within the parties, but between the parties. The electors are already being set. And you have to have your electors set by a certain point in time. And I don't know what the states create all those laws, which is why they usually, the two parties or the uniparties, require it all be done by June or something like that, so that by July they can start having their conventions. And this is where they choose their running mate. So this past week, Trump chose Vance. And so the way the state law is that whoever the vice president whoever the president chooses for vice president, because they've already determined that's the ticket. The Democrats, because Biden and Kamala Harris, the duo was going to move forward, then it's locked. So in other words, folks, going into the Democratic committee, or I should say convention, the Democratic National Convention, the DNC, I think in the next week or two, if Biden says he's not running, it's too late to put another president in. And what that means is the electors don't have a vote for president. And because this is the way they allowed the laws to be locked down like this, now it's too late because the people already confirmed that they wanted Biden and Harris. And so Harris has the lock for vice president. She cannot take that place. So in other words, when the electors vote, and if they actually vote for Harris as president, then they're violating the party framework and the laws the states have made to allow them to have these locks. Even though it's all unconstitutional, and even though you've heard me say that the electors are to be chosen by the people and the electors are always free to choose how they want to vote, you hear me say this, because that's the truth,
bottom line, because that constitutionally, they can't do those things. Constitutionally, they cannot create these tickets. They cannot create winner take all. The Constitution doesn't allow it. They can't have primaries and caucuses, but they already did. And they've been following this. They made their bed. And now let's watch how the RNC allows the DNC to wiggle. Watch what happens, because the uniparty is going to be twisting and writhing, and it'll be all hyperbole, but there will be no consequences. Because, in this point in time, we have to squirm, so you have to let us squirm, because we're all in this together. Because that's how corrupt the system is. Now, if Trump and his campaign is smart, then he will basically stand up, and he should be standing up, and stating, this can't happen. The caucuses and the party ticket allowed for a locked ticket. So they allowed for a locked ticket for president and vice president, Biden and Harris being the presidential ticket, or I should say the ticket for the Democrats. So moving into the general election, based on the laws of the states, show me where once they've locked in the president and the vice president, show me in the states where the national party can choose or actually swap out and say whatever Democrats, because you don't choose a Democrat. Why do we have primaries? The whole point of the primary is to lock down who those candidates are going to be. Once you've had those done, it's done. Now it's just a general vote between, do we want the Democratic ticket or the Republican ticket or the Constitution Party ticket or the Libertarian ticket? That's it. It's not constitutional, but that's how the states have created these laws, and that's how they've been getting away with stealing the presidency for over a century. So what are you going to do about it? Do you want to create a petition? Then we have a petition out there that you could probably start playing with, but it may not be posted. I think it is actually the presidential ticket, I should say, or the petition one on our petition page would need some serious revamping, but that's the one where you would start, because we actually go through that electoral college process. I'm not sure what anybody wants to do, and I'm not here to try to, intimidate or compel or force anybody to do anything. But folks, this is your liberty. Folks, this is your future. If you don't start drawing the line, I mean, we already put the financial context at the beginning of every show to this. It's either now or never, and they're going to collapse this nation under this guise of this fraudulent debt and say, we can't do this anymore. We have to surrender to a global governing body. Folks, either you wise up and you start getting serious about preserving your liberty and saving this country, because we have a self-governing system, and it's not self-governing anymore. We actually have a judiciary form of government. We have a democratic form of government. We have a party form of government and a corporate form of government. We have every form of government other than a Republican form of government. And the only way you're going to get your Republican form of government back is by demanding that your county commissioners either do their job or you replace them this election. Whoever is in office, and if they're not willing to actually go to the state legislature and start demanding compliance of the Constitution, then you're better off replacing them with whoever else is on the ticket, a Democrat, what have you. Sadly, there's way too many commissioners that go unopposed. We need you to actually do this. If you're thinking that one man like Trump can save this nation, he can't and he won't. One, nobody knows how, and because it has to start at the grassroots. It has to start at the county. We have to take back the states, and the states actually have to get the federal government into line. That is the natural order of contract law. Going any other direction, doing it any other way, is not within the framework of the Constitution. If the president disbanded a couple of offices, education, and so forth, the next president could actually reinstitute them because it wasn't done properly. The only way to actually decommission, demolish, and disintegrate these unconstitutional vestiges, these departments, these powers, these roles, so forth and so on, the only way to do that is for the states to direct Congress to either get back and undo all of these unconstitutional things, and these will be one by one by one directives. Department of Education, not constitutional. You have no authority to be even taxing us a penny for that. Get rid of it. And then give them the stipulations of how to do that. Again, you've heard me say this, that we can't be foolhardy by just shutting down everything in D.C. in one fell swoop. It has to be done methodically over time. You can't just unemploy a couple million people in the D.C. area just like that. But those people who are smart, they will leave early, they'll just abandon their jobs, and they will actually go find work elsewhere. Those who are in the denial, this is why who moved my cheese? You're going to see lots of mice and rats in denial and trying to fight for this unconstitutional government. And no matter what court they go into, it doesn't matter. They don't have jurisdiction. The ultimate call, and this is why I say this, because people come to me and go, well, you know, that's not what the courts say. You know, as a matter of fact, these Publiuses and so forth, that, you know, they constantly say, oh, well, the states don't have that kind of say. But you know what? Madison differs with you. And as a matter of fact, this is how I address this when people try to be the deniers. Well, let's see when we actually tell the states and empower them with the power they have, and they start asserting and start using the Constitution to dismantling this Leviathan, then you tell the states that they don't have that power as they execute the power that the Constitution gives them. And they, you know, they don't realize that right there in Article 4, the states can extradite every single congressperson if they are violating their oath. Section 3 demands it. And so this is how we get rid of everybody in Congress. And next thing you know, those states, those 27, those 28 states, once they actually have a full unanimity in demanding full compliance of the Constitution, then guess what? Everything will be dismantled because they're up for the job. They're actually going to do what's necessary. Now, again, the point is that we can't just do this brutally. There's no way we could withstand that. There's no way D.C. would just boil down. I should say meltdown. That would probably be better. But anyway, as we look at what's going to be played out, what we saw in 2020 was a huge constitutional crisis, and nobody wanted to really do anything. We had quite a few people signing petitions going into it. But once the petitions were presented to Congress and they ignored those and did nothing, and Bob pursued that lawsuit and sued Congress for violating the Constitution, and the court did nothing at the D.C. court and the Supreme Court. Oh, well, you don't have standing. Well, nobody, when it comes down to the court having superior power over all things, then nothing has standing compared to them. And if they choose not to do anything, they will tell you you have no standing, that only they have that ultimate standing. And when it comes to the Constitution and violations, all things that arise under that Constitution, they have to see and hear. That is where their jurisdiction lies. It's not about standing when we're talking about direct constitutional violations. So Unfortunately, we didn't get any support. Unfortunately, we didn't get enough support to move state attorney generals, because we could have forced the federal courts to actually pick up that lawsuit and force the Supreme Court to actually weigh in and provide a judgment. How? Because once you have two attorney generals that are joined to the case, it forces the Supreme Court to actually pull in the case to review. Now, I'm going to guess that the Supreme Court doesn't necessarily care for this concept of being forced. I don't know very many people that like to be forced. All I do know is that the Constitution, when you have two states that step in and say, hey, we consider this important. Now, it may have actually would have, I'm sure that the Supreme Court would have said, well, this isn't enough. And they may have actually said, okay, we need five states. We need something that actually proves that it's not just two states. But folks, it just baffles me how these attorney generals, how these Republican states, these red states, fail to actually step forward and dismantle this unconstitutional seating of Biden. So in other words, this, you know, I'm not prognosticating, but in other words, until you or we, the people, actually start really clamoring and we start, and you know what? You don't have to go out and duke fists, you know, out in the streets with these radical Antifa communist revolutionary Bolsheviks. You don't have to do that, folks. These are petitions that you get signed and you take to your county commissioners. And if you're in a red county, then we can help you get those county commissioners to create a symbiotic relationship with you. Because bottom line, if you have a solid county commissioner that actually wants to actually help, and they get on board with holding the state accountable and solving all of these problems, then what we have, and this is the beautiful thing, we now actually have a symbiotic relationship where the county commissioners can go out and have town hall meetings and, you know, say, hey, we need to have a meeting with your group, because they know who the groups are, the Republican Party, the Women's Republicans, and all these different clubs and so forth. They can actually start pulling together. They can start communicating. And more importantly, they can and they will, if they're willing to create that symbiotic relationship, they'll create that committee or that super jury of the, and I'll call it a broad or wide representation of the county. In other words, what they should do is they should make sure that every precinct or every so many precincts that are adjoined, creating these little districts or clusters, or what have you, that you have so many people from each, so that you have 50, you have 60, 80, 100 people that are a part of this committee, so that the committee, all you need is a majority, just like with the grand jury. And this is where we actually can start making all, this is where we make the stand and say, this is the only constitution we recognize. These are the powers you have. These are the things you can do. So that anything that is not within that square hole or that round hole, then that peg ain't going to fit. You don't even try putting it in there anymore. Quit it. It's not enumerated. You can't meddle with it. So if you go through the petitions, this is why we wrote those things the way we did, to hold government accountable as we start moving up moving down the chain of command. The top of the chain of command is we the people. And the next phase or the next step in the chain is your county legislators. They're the ones, this is, as you read Why Counties Matter Most, you'll realize why it is so important to have a county constitution. And how once you get enough counties, once you have a critical mass where you have a certain percentage, I'd like to, and I think that what it should state in the county constitution is a two-thirds majority, or when you have two-thirds of the counties that agree, then you will convene a convention, if necessary, to rewrite the state constitution. This gives us the power. And this takes back the democracy mob rule out of the what we call the population centers, these urban areas that are densely populated with a bunch of radicals, illegals, and so forth. So as we kind of wrap up, let me just kind of put this at bay. It's not going to be pretty, and nobody's going to like what the heck's going to be happening coming down the pike as we move towards the general election, because they're literally going to get away with, and that's because the Republican, the RNC, is going to allow them to do this. They'll use this hyperbole. They may take it into courts, but they're not going to take it to you, the people. They're not going to say this is unconstitutional. They're not even going to admit that what they have done thus far for the past century and a half plus, since 1856, that they have been duping and perverting the process of choosing the president. There's no way they'll own up to that. But when you read the documentation and you say, well, that's how it, why do we have a 12th Amendment? Because they needed to make minor changes to the process. And that minor change was, instead of actually putting two names without identifying president or vice president, you just put two names. The only prerequisite was that both names could not be from that state. You had to choose one name at a minimum, if not both, but one name at a minimum could not be a resident of that state. So, as you kind of walk through that entire process, the 12th Amendment really just made some minor changes. Minor changes. When we look at what we have today, there is no way that's a minor change. So what we have is such a significant deviation from the Constitution. And if we don't do something about it, the globalists will continue to move us and interest along. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the only way we can really do anything about what's happening at the federal level is by getting the states to step in. You know, the federal government realizes that when we, the people, are trying to fight our government at the federal level, we've lost. Which is why they've constantly pandered and constantly convinced you that, hey, as long as you let them, give them the latitude to operate outside that Constitution, they'll do all sorts of things. Which is how they've embedded themselves in so many people's lives in so many different ways that most people do not want to feel the pain, because they believe, oh, well, if we stop all of this, that all has to stop. And that's true. It has to stop. Social Security has to stop as a function, but it doesn't mean that we can't honor that. I mean, Milton Friedman was very clear that it is just wrong for all of those people to have that promise. But the liability of all of the promises of the federal government today is insurmountable. I think it's necessary, because it's absolutely cruel and unusual punishment to not allow those people who live their life banking on that retirement. I really, when we look at the civil service and those civil servants that have been working in positions that, you know, retired and so forth, that may be something else, but they can't continue with their full benefits. Social Security is something different. And I say this because Social Security is basically the poor man, the common man. Congress and public servants, in other words, those with federal retirement programs, those are parachutes. Why didn't they create those same kind of parachutes for the citizens? Oh, well, they knew, and all these people worked. And bottom line, they had been undermined by the fact that they went away from gold, they went away from silver, and they were able to create fiat currency. And they have hurt the American citizen, or I should say the American retiree. So what we have to do, and this actually deflates everything, when the federal government isn't pouring out as much money into the civil service side, and we actually downsize all of those jobs. So all of those, I mean, who makes the most amount of money in America? It's the politicians and the people working in government. Why is it that D.C. has the highest housing cost in anywhere. I mean, I believe the D.C. is even more expensive than Hawaii. I may be wrong because I'm just speaking off the cuff. But the bottom line is, folks, we have the power to fix this problem. And what we're seeing is lots of people getting hurt, and you're standing by. Stop standing by. Start getting involved. Most everybody that listens to the show knows quite a few people. I don't think we have very many islands anymore that have, you know, don't have any, you know, associations and like-minded friends and so forth. As a matter of fact, this is what I tell people, even in a blue county, we can help you actually get through with the Republic, not the Republican power structure, but we can help you actually overthrow your power structure. Unless you're living in the city, I consider some of these cities wastelands. You know, I work directly with a person in a major U.S. city that they're destitute because there's no hope for them. You can't get enough people in that city, or at least, well, I can't say that. I believe God will perform the miracles if we start working on faith. There's no doubt in my mind He will actually open the windows of heaven if we start acting, as we start behaving, and we start doing what he demands that we do. We need to get ourselves right, but we can't just get ourselves right. We have to also be focused on trying to get this country right. Right? So in other words, we got the double duty. Those who need to repent, those who need to make the changes, start making those changes. But that's something on your own. Now, you know, outside of that, we have a responsibility to fix and heal this government. And hopefully you might be able to draw the parallel between both of them to realize this is what happens when we do not. It's kind of like a penny. If you don't take care of a penny, or you don't take care of any type of coin, it starts to tarnish. It starts to get worn down. It loses its luster. Well, our relationship with our Creator should not lose its luster. Our relationship with our government should not lose its luster. So it's no surprise to me at all, none, that we're in this situation, that we're in this position, that as far as I see this, we have lost the luster ourselves, and all's we need to do, because I think maybe we're that coin in this metaphor. We need to clean ourselves up. We need to clean our government up. We've got to roll up our sleeves to do that. I can't say that America can be healed strictly through, because I know miracles can be performed through prayer. But I believe that is dead without works. And so we actually have to do something. We have to get out there. We have to get involved. And so with that, we'll be back. We're doing the ratification debates Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So Friday, hopefully we'll have Tammy Young or some other interview. Folks, we're reclaiming the Republic, and I'm begging you, we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic review. Please read my argument for Republic review, as well as my description of the Republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.